panels, this discussion session, we put in a panel and we tried to invite people on it that represent the breadth of perspectives here. And this is how I write them, and the people invited, Alex, Chaslov, John, and again, now you know why I had to sit there, and Gavin are invited in the order as at least how I see these distinctions. And of course, there is overlap between each of these, but I think that's what we've seen at this meeting. We've had a good discussion of basic formalism and the whole logic of indefinite causal order. And we've had also from Alex and from others and from Chaslov and others, a discussion of how these ideas and about indefinite causal order are actually implemented or could be implemented in quantum physics. And then John, I include myself in this category, like to calculate things. And I can't name everybody, I'm not excluding you. Anyway, how do you actually calculate things connected with this? And then Gavin likes to deal with the real world empirically, which is very important, but Tim said something about that with these satellite experiments. So of course there is overlap here, but I just wanted to give the reason for this ordering and separation. And so what I think is good for a panel is to allow panel time to discuss an audience to ask questions of them. So I've got a few questions, and we won't do them all at once. But the first is multiple choice. And for the panelists, and then you can get comments. What do you think time is? Is it A, fundamental, B, emergent, C, both, D, neither, and if it's D, then tell me what you think it is if it's none of the above. Alex. Fundamental, emergent, both, or neither. And give a short reason. We don't, if you could.
Oh, yeah.
If you can't, say I can't.
I'll say B.
Emergent.
So we talk about a compound system, a complex system, and we wonder how the pieces of this system is connected to the other pieces. That connectivity is time.
Okay. Chaslov. Fundamental, emergent, both, or neither.
Every morning when I wake up and I look at the mirror, I find that it flows. It's real. I don't know whether it's emergent or fundamental, but I guess I'm closest to something as relational.
So neither, and you'd say relational.
Yeah.
To be called John, what would you say?
No, I don't know. I'm tempted to go with both. Get all possible answers coming out of this thing. At some level, we do feel it's a parameter. It's much like spatial extent. Is spatial extent emergent because you have to use a religion to measure it? But there's some sense that it's fundamental too. You're measuring something fundamental and using a tool. The tool quantifies it, in that sense it's emergent. Clocks quantify time. But there's something going on. Maybe it's the causal relations that make some time. There's something going on, but the way we understand it is somewhat emergent.
And Gavin?
So I don't know if it's emergent or if it's fundamental, but I see it, but it's something, I think it's something where we can understand it from how we use it. When we're in the lab and we measure frequency or we measure a time period, That's how I see it, as just in an operational way, in a practical, mundane way, as something that we, something that is defined by how we use it in the lab.
So you, it does. I would say that you're D, neither, you give a utilitarian answer. Okay, any comments on this? Does anybody want to say how they feel about time? Yeah.
I'd just like to clarify your question. Are you asking about time or space-time?
Time.
Seems to me that given that you can convert between space and time, I don't see how time could be emergent if space isn't, or vice versa.
Okay.
I was also asking for clarification of fundamental.
Well, okay, that of course depends on who's asking the question, but I guess it's me. I was inspired, there was a meeting about at Perimeter held in the Sky Room, I can't remember, a year and a half ago, I think. June. Anyway, this kind of question was put to a vote. Is time, I bifurcated it into four because we have a smaller group, but basically the audience there were about twice as many people as here, was asked if they thought time was fundamental, emergent, or something else, and the audience was split three ways, basically. So fundamental, I guess, I think is probably closest to a Newtonian concept of time. You could say that time is what clocks measure, but the thing measured is logically, ontologically prior to that which is doing the measuring. Whereas emergent means, my understanding would be, if you look deep enough, then time dissolves into some other thing that is not as ontologically prior, kind of like a cloud is an emergent phenomenon relative to the water droplets and atoms in the cloud. And then both, maybe they're not mutually exclusive concepts. Maybe we would find time is a bit like a cloud, but if you get there, you'll still find something underlying the cloud that is indeed fundamental, but is not decouplable from time, and then neither means, I don't like any of these categories, so it's relational or it's utilitarian. That's what I was trying to do. Ajay.
So a couple of years ago, we did this interesting calculation about ideal clocks, the concept of ideal clocks, which is in special relativity a device that measures proper time. And the proper time has this property that only depends on the instantaneous velocity and does not depend on acceleration of the clock. And the question is whether such devices exist that do not feel acceleration. And if you think of any reasonable clock, like an atomic clock in the lab, if you accelerate such a thing, then all the lasers will just fall from the table, from the optical table. If you take a pendulum clock and accelerate, it also is being broken by acceleration. So the question is whether such devices exist at all. So the most fundamental clock that would do that for you, the measure proper time, would be a point like particle of decays, like muon. So you're asking the question whether accelerated muon decays according to the, time dilation formula. And appears it's not. Appears that even muon feels acceleration and the decay rate depends on the acceleration. It appears at very high accelerations when you experience the Unruh effect, but it's there, which means that the concept of proper time cannot be really measured with any existing device in a universal way. So even if you don't go far to the quantum gravity limit, even within quantum field theory, you already have operational difficulties with defining what time is when you experience strong accelerations.
So with an atomic clock, why can't you accelerate it? If you have a box with a laser and some atoms and a measuring device, one rigid black box, why can't you accelerate
it? Just if you accelerate it fast enough, it's not really anymore.
It's not,
if you just accelerate it strong enough, it's going to break eventually. It's high acceleration.
Eventually,
but he's talking about 10 to the 20 Gs or something like
that. Yeah, strong accelerations.
I
just wanted to point out that Lucian Hardy, in one of his papers, came up with the idea of... Just to remind you, use the idea of a thermal clock that basically uses the second law of thermodynamics as a way of measuring time. So you just have something that gradually thermalizes. Would that work, do you think?
Sorry,
Trevelli, maybe?
Yeah, this sounds all like Trevelli, the person you mentioned.
Are you disowning the idea?
Yeah. I had the idea of a fluid drop where the two things mix. Maybe
that's kind of what I was thinking of, yeah.
Okay.
Not temperature, but mixing, yeah.
Correct, yeah, mix. Okay.
Any other comments?
So, in the theme of this conference, so following on from what Tim said, so special relativity and general relativity teach us that we want to put space and time on the same footing to some extent. And there's that beautiful quote from Minkowski about the two things. I can't remember the quote, unfortunately, but it's impossible to separate the two.
Yes, now space and time are joined. And...
yeah. But still it's the case, even though they are sort of joined in some deep way, that you can say this interval is space-like and this one is time-like always. But if we have indefinite causal structure, then that ceases to be the case. So there will be some deeper sense in which space and time were inextricably joined together. I'm not sure how that reflects on the question you asked. It seems to me that that there's something which is fundamental, and it's the stuff out of which indefinite causal structure is built. So whether that's time or not, I don't know.
Well, that could be a both kind of answer.
Yeah. But emerging,
I think Alex wanted to make a point.
I was following up both on Tim and Lucy. The sentiment was like, okay, the lesson of general relativity is space-time. We have this four-dimensional space. But like, why do we always like, why is that the lesson? If I formulate GR in the canonical approach, there then I have superspace, and I have a space of three geometries, and I have a space of matter. And so then like I can sort of do away with this four-dimensional space-time picture and just have the space of three geometries and matter. And then the time would be some relational thing between the matter and the geometry. So like, is it, I don't know, I don't want to say the idea of space-time four-dimensional manifold is misleading, but there's other formulations of GR where we don't have to make reference to the four-dimensional space-time. So,
I guess Jacques wanted.
Just wanted to add that there's also formulations where you have more than one time. So you could go the other way too.
Sure.
So
is there
one thing,
order between,
to
display my ignorance, is there an order between these three-dimensional geometries?
I think, as I understand, like a priori, not no, and then...
But a specific solution, what does it, is it?
It describes some state of the three geometries and the matter that would be the solution to the conditions, as I understand it.
And then, yeah, since you have a constraint, This solution exists, determines the solution for all time. That's the timeless formalism. So the way times appear here is more you postulate a fundamental symmetry principle, which is the relativity principle.
But our time is like a parameter that you can...
that you choose at will. You can choose that slice, that slice. There's an infinite number of choices of time evolution. There's nothing... In that classical GR formulation, there's nothing fundamental about your choice of time.
My choice, but there are these slices. I can consider that. I can consider this slice.
And there's no preferred physical slices.
They cannot be preferred, but they're all there.
Well, there is a notion of space-like, time-like, and light-like relationships.
There is a notion of space-like,
so
time-like. And, yeah,
that's
yeah.
Really what
but the slice-like, what you call time, does not exist. The notion of causality, yeah, is still there, but the notion of time... is sliced. Notion of time is a choice of slicing of your space time. And
yes.
Since
this space of my space time,
yes.
Of my super space, a slice of my super space or of my space time? Yeah.
Both. You can view it as a parameter that you superimpose to super space. And that parameter.
But is the notion that taught that there's nothing fundamental about time necessarily an Einsteinian concept? One could say the same thing about Newton. You could imagine Newtonian physicists saying, okay, there's sort of an absolute time, but really we can slice it different ways, and as long as we recover the Galilean principle, right? I mean, I've got some clocks run slow, some clocks run fast, I can set the zero. It's not as fungible, but as it is in relativity with space, but is it really different in kind?
Like,
could a Newtonian have said time is, well, like, by definition, Newton thought what time was fundamental, as I understand
yeah.
it, but could one in that paradigm say that time is emergent?
I don't know. I would say that Newton, no, you have a splitting between space and, I mean, it's prior. And then you think of evolution as motion, right? And of course, you can formulate it into a constraint system. So in that sense, you could say, well, I can pretend it's Einsteinian, but the constraint will always have there's an inequality between how time translation appears versus space translation. So it's kind of a fake. Whereas in the Einsteinian concept, Einstein is very radical. At the classical level, it's just saying, well, there's no such thing as motion for an isolated system. An isolated system is. And it is what? The world line. That's it. And where does time appear? It appears only when two world lines interact or intersect. That's it. Before any interaction, there is no time. That's deeper than, that's more radical than Newton.
Sorry,
Fabio,
I think.
So Leibniz at the same time as Newton was having a very different conception of time, so of the space and time. I think that the discussion was mostly about space, but if you push them, probably they would have said the same things about time. And so I think Leibniz, well, it's generally recognized to have had a very relational approach to physical quantity, but they ascribe to the same physics. So I would say that the Newtonian physics is consistent with the relational interpretation of time. So you can say even there are things you can only talk about. Time doesn't exist. It's just you look from outside, and then it's everything only relational. But then I think there is a very important physical difference, which is the Galilean symmetry clearly picks up one time direction and one space direction in a way that the Lorentz symmetry doesn't. So I think that there is a distinction between having different interpretations that you say, is it relational or not, or having a really different type of symmetry. So in the case of the Newtonian physics, even if you ascribe to a relational time, you still have to accept that you cannot just switch around space and time arbitrarily, that there is in the physics of how things happen, there is some...
You mean in the Newtonian?
In the Newtonian physics, in according to a physics that is Galilean invariant, it picks up a time direction. Even if you're a relationalist, you would have to accept it.
I'd like to argue in favor of the ontology of time, somehow, in response to these ideas that we can formulate physics without it. The way I understood
classical physics.
So, that's because that's how I understood the question. And so, like, let's take you can have the superspace representation, or you may have also another representation, which is in four-dimensional space-time. In some sense, there is a correspondence of this entity that would be called time. Of course, we know that there is a diffeomorphism invariance, so somehow the label itself, or the precise way you would write down the solutions over this space-time is not physical, but there seems to me something about, let's say, naive picture of solution of classical fields over space-time. You have the three-dimensional some foliation that somehow this sequence of three-dimensional surfaces is there. I mean, I can parameterize it differently because there isn't somehow a background, but nevertheless, there is something about that. I mean, we need this extra dimension, whether we hide it in a superspace or somewhere else. It feels like it is a necessary parameter to describe the physics. And in that sense, I would say that it seems like it corresponds to something that's out there.
That's the fundamental word, yeah.
Yes.
Do I dare ask the audience to vote? How many would vote A, it's fundamental?
What are the choices before we
fundamental, emergent, both, or neither? But I'm not going to ask everybody to clarify the neither.
Can I propose another option, which is, I think, for me, it would be that time is fundamentally quantum. So that's why I emphasize classical.
Well,
the reason, maybe I could say one word about that, is that in relativity, it's very interesting. So the reason there's no time is because H is equal to zero. The Hamiltonian vanish, right? That's relativity. So if the Hamiltonian vanish, it's a constraint, the variable dual to the Hamiltonian, which is time, is a pure gauge. Okay, so that's kind of the Einsteinian essence of why classically. Now, what happened to that constraint h equal to zero at the quantum level? It becomes h psi. It's not equal to zero. It's equal to a delta function. It becomes a Green function. So the way you quantize a time constraint in general is very different from the way you quantize a space constraint, let's say a spin constraint. So when we quantize, so this is a distinction. So at the classical level, all constraints are equal. At the quantum level, time constraints are broken. And because they are broken, time becomes physical. So if you look at what is the variable conjugated to H, it is the phase of the wave function. And when they measure time, what do they measure? They measure that phase. And in fact, you know, that phase is really what we call proper time. But that phase exists. So the Einsteinian theory is telling you that phase does not exist classically. It exists only quantum mechanically. Okay, so that would be my fifth option, that time is fundamentally quantum.
Okay, well, I will let people be agnostic about whether they want to answer it from a quantum, a classical, or both. But I still want, I'm curious to see how it compares to that other meeting. So you'll all have to vote, right? So how many vote A, fundamental?
That's fundamental.
One, two, three, four, five. Okay, how many vote B, emergent? One, two, three, four. My former students and present students don't agree. Anyway, four. Five for fundamental. Okay, how many vote C? It's both. One, two, three, four, five, six.
What does that mean?
And then the other is neither. You don't like any of those.
One.
Has everybody voted? Two, three, four. Well, that's about as even a split as you can imagine, which I guess is what makes this.
No, we need the panel to distinguish.
Well, I mean, we had an emergent, a neither, a both, and a neither. So the neither, how many were neithers again? Four neithers plus two. That's six neithers. So I'm so right. So A is the fundamental. We had five. B was emergent. And we had how many emergents? I think we had about same. Can you raise your hand? Come on, don't you can't change your vote. One, two, three, four. Only four. And Alex said. Oh, right. And Alex, that's five. That's why I thought there were five. C is both. How many are on the both end? One, two, three, four, five, six. And it's like Canadian Parliament. And D is, who's the D? That was six again, is that right? Yeah, okay.
Did you vote?
Yeah, I did. I'm here. Yeah.
We needed a tiebreaker.
Neither. Well, I mean, this is about as even as you could get, right? I mean, okay, well, that's very interesting. And I do wonder how these prejudices guided. Now, I would say I'm an A, despite all the, I think it's interesting to explore these others, but I keep coming back to the fact they all are motivated because we're really secretly, we know in our hearts A is true. I guess I wonder what would convince me to change my vote, but I try to be open-minded every time that you could look at it relationally. You could look at it this way. But
yeah,
preach it, brother. Well, except that I guess I'd say, you know, yeah, I mean, if I were to switch, I'd go with both, would be my next port of call. But anyway, all right, unless somebody wants to say something else. One thing I noticed, nobody said anything about causality in all of this definition of time. Sorry.
So the word emergent, I don't really like it. I'm not sure what it means. I understand what it means if you're talking about how water is emergent from moving around.
I mean, something like
a very microscopic versus macroscopic kind of word. But I feel like a different meaning is creeping in here, I'm not sure about it. There's at least, how many people? There's 11 people who
think the word emergent has some application here. So what do people mean that? Like water molecules and the water, is that what people mean?
Alex wants to
respond. What I mean is that in some limit where I have an ideal clock, my clock gets big, I ignore quantum fluctuations of it or something like this, then I get the usual time evolution. So I would say it's an emergent in that limit.
But what about the proper time of fundamental particle?
Yeah, I mean, I think this should
be... That 0.02 is
it? Well, I mean, I would say that this is the observable that's conjugate to its internal energy.
Can I add one?
But that's not a big one, right?
What do you mean
it's
not a big one?
Okay, wait, now Andrzej wants to say something.
So when Pythagoras discovered that the diameter of a square is not a rational number, he hid that fact because it was indecent, like he hid it for a while. And Rovelli, like 2,000 years later, claims that there is no such thing as in physics in reality as a point or anything continuous. These are just concepts that cannot really exist in reality. So that kind of motivates me to say emergent because as time as we understand it right now, it's something continuous. And for that reason, I cannot sympathize with Pythagoras and with
so the line.
I guess one should clarify that. I suppose we didn't mean time, the classical time. I mean, we don't know its properties. I commit to the existence of something that may have bizarre properties, more bizarre than we believe them, but...
okay, I want your coach as well.
Yeah, so if I understand, Alex, you should be in the D group, because it was emergent from the relational point of view, and I guess the better word is that it's not well defined. Like, if your clock is not ideal clock, if this is a finite dimensional, and you look at the relational, you will not have a very defined time.
Yeah.
Which is not the same as emergence, how I understand.
Yeah, I would know.
So that's why I should
put
him in
the table. Yeah, that's why he's waiting for neither side.
But when you say incompatible with A, are we saying that time, I mean, the question is time an absolute observable or a relative observable? I mean, of course, it's a relative observable. But it could be for me, when I say it's fundamental, of course it is a relative observable, but it can still be a fundamental. Or do we exclude relative observable are not fundamental?
No, I don't. But you said that under fundamental, the best closest description was some kind of Newtonian time.
Well, what Amit said, it's ontologically prior. I don't see how it's ultimately ontologically reducible to something else. Now, I'm open-minded as to what maybe what one would say is how it's measured. I mean, clearly we have different clocks that read differently. We have different time zones, but that is all gloss, I think, over what is ontologically prior about time. That's what I would say.
Maybe I just give a try to like, if you would, I guess if you would have just one object in the whole universe, and then you can still assume that there is ontological time, although I don't know what it will be operationally. But as soon as you have, let's say, this is crucification, if you have two objects, you can look at some kind of relational property and only then start to define time as kind of change of the relational property.
Well, I mean, again, but that's an operational question relative to what's ontologically prior, because the ontologically prior people could say, sure, it's relational, but that lives on the substrate of that ontology. Anyway, I want to move on to something else, if we could. Well, people seem to be having fun with this. We have these different approaches, so something I thought would be interesting to ask, what synergies, so this is back for the panel, what synergies between these approaches look promising? How can we get more productive results and understanding in this way? And maybe I'll start here and go to the other end.
Yeah, so it's really been great to be here at this meeting to see the benefits of theorists coming together with an experimentalist to see the possible improvements in understanding quantum gravity. I really, have been asking everybody to try and specify what is measurable and what is testable, because to me then that's really important, and that's how we can have more progress. Which is just sort of sounds like a bit like saying, oh, you know, my bit's the most important, which is obviously not the case. You know, the brilliant theory of quantum gravity would presumably be obvious on its own. But if we're stuck, then please come up with testable predictions and try and work on that together.
So, John, you said a lot of this stuff was out of your comfort zone. How do you see this?
So, in some ways, I'd like to agree that experiment is the best thing. One of the fun things that I came out of the meeting is that many of these ideas have experimental realizations. As far as getting real experimental insight into quantum gravity, I have to admit that I'm relatively optimistic, because the scales that we're operating on are so far from those where quantum gravity is really going to operate. I don't expect that we will see experimental evidence on quantum gravity in the lab. But nevertheless, I think I love seeing attempts to make analog systems of it. I love seeing attempts to do tests that will confirm what we are prejudices.
Do you think particle physics ideas and approaches should be imported in these other directions? I mean, it's hard for you to say no.
Of course, we're the center of the universe. It would be nice if some more insights were useful.
Okay, Jeff.
Well, I think so far this is one of those good workshops, and I feel that in the last maybe one or two decades, this operational approach brought us to the now maybe most interesting question: how to combine causality, gravity, and quantum, and that this made some kind of shift in the, or another view, that we are still lacking people who can combine these four elements above, or who are trained both in quantum gravity and have operational approach. And that's why it's so hard to make the progress from the different sides, your own side. But we are on a good path, and this operational approach somehow liberate you from some concepts that are so embedded in certain specific quantum gravity approaches. Well, about the experiment, I think, basically we have no clue, so I would kind of disagree. So we absolutely have no clue where to look at. And I would be very optimistic, and I would just encourage the experimentalists to look at all possible corners. And there is one lesson that I, from my own experience, and this is, for example, at some point I was looking at microscopic thermodynamical entanglement weaknesses, and it turns out that some of the very simple things like heat capacity could be an entanglement weakness. So if you look at the data of the measured heat capacity, you can maybe find out whether the ground state, for example, is entangled as you go lower to the lower temperatures. Now, heat capacity people could measure long before quantum mechanics was born. And then I was looking, but this is more of a kind of history of physics project, but so I haven't finished this. But I came with the papers that were dangerously close to when Schrödinger introduced a coin name entanglement, if I'm not mistaken, was this 35 or yeah. And so I came Really, so what I want to propose that people make, even before knowing quantum theory, but still before understanding what entanglement is, or even thinking about something like that, it's possible, could have looked at this data of the heat capacity and find out that they cannot simulate this by separable states. And so there is absolutely no reasons not to believe that maybe something similar can be seen also from the quantum gravity point of view. Of course, I have no clue where to look at
Alex. Yeah, so
look at him late night.
Fun formalism. So I think maybe I'll say first what I think formalism does, and then I think what it wants. So I'm not a physicist. I mean, that's not really my background, which means I come at these problems with a quite different perspective. But I never would have understood these problems, these questions about indefinite causal structure, had I not read, for instance, papers of Giulio and Chaslav and so on, who put it into this language of something which is not overtly physics. It's something about channels or maps, okay? Maps of maps. And then that's a thing that looking at as a computer scientist, I know what a map of a map is, and ask very precise questions about it and try to solve them. But just because you can ask questions and try to solve them doesn't necessarily mean those are good questions to ask, or those are the ones you should ask. And that's, I think, where it's useful to talk to concepts and even to go around mod four to experiments and say, you know, what is an interesting question? Can we get towards speaking the same language and work toward a solution and go, I guess, either +2 or -2 mod 4 to calculation and ask if we can actually efficiently solve these things within some forms.
I'm tempted with the four elements to say it's earth, air, water, fire, but I suppose that's so. Any other comments? Oh, sorry.
I think with experiments, then it's not my type of experiments, but astrophysics could be, you know, experimental astrophysics could be a fruitful place to try and formulate new experiments, you know, like Tim and Rob, you know, that's sort of, I think, moving towards that.
Well, we already know in astrophysics that there are things that don't fit.
But we also know there are things that fit really, really, really well, like binary pulsar and gravity waves, and that's why it's so challenging, right?
Yep.
But anyway, any comments from the audience about what are good synergies, or maybe what's the most fruitful way to move this concept of indefinite causal order and related work forward? Or maybe we're already doing the best we can.
I mean, earlier you had a question which I like very much. So let's go over the question of scale. Planck scale is very small, you know, but let's assume for a moment as a fantasy that it's not that small. So what kind of experiment, you know, Suppose it's really close, then what are we going to see? What kind of experiment? You know, it's more, maybe it's going to be more a third experiment to go with what you're saying. I think we really had, as theorists, tunnel vision into what kind of experiment we should do, and it was driven by particle physics, and then based on particle physics type of experiment, quantum gravity is deemed unobservable. But as you mentioned, you know, you could say, you know, the sky is blue, water is boiling, this is due to quantum mechanics. So quantum mechanics was observed way before it was observed. So it's just a question of looking at it the right way. And so maybe having this, I don't know, having a meeting where we all pretend that the Planck scale is there, And we come up with a, you know, unrealistic experiment, but I don't know, that would be, I like this exercise that you propose at some point, like,
yeah, I mean,
suppose the scale is, you know, MeV, then what would you see in terms of causal structure? What would happen to you? Or, and then maybe some of them would be closer than we think they are.
Sure.
Any other comments? People had more fun talking about time.
Someone else on that? So what would we see if the flight scales were not supposed
to? Maybe a comment, maybe in line with some other comments with the sky and the flight scale. I think, yeah, this concept of scale, I think it's a little misleading because it's a huge landscape of things that can happen in parameters. So of course, if you think about accelerators, that there is one parameter that you can crank up and down, and then it's a one-dimensional line, and it's quantum gravity at the very end of the line. But but in the world, we don't have just one way to probe things. So that's why, yeah, there are these kind of emergent phenomena that, like, you can observe the Planck scale by looking at the blackbody radiation. It's, you cannot explain it otherwise, and it's very macroscopic. And what scale is that? Is MeV? I mean, it's, yeah, you can put a label, but so, yeah, just say, I think this phrasing everything as one scale, this is something that comes from this exercise. I mean, you learn quantum field theory, you put H bar equal C equal one, and then there is just one scale, but it's, I think it's a little misleading. So, yeah, I'm siding with that direction. What type of things you can see? Well, we have these, these thought experiments about superposing space times and causal structure and what can happen. So that's one of the things people have mentioned it later. We'll also talk about it tomorrow. That's very interesting, I find, but it's not, I don't think it teaches much about new physics, unfortunately. So I don't really know any controversial experiment we could try to make. This is, I think, the very challenging question. What is the type of experiment that we don't really agree what will happen, and we have to develop new ideas. So maybe Hawking radiation and vacuum evaporation type of things, that's where maybe things get messy.
So you're asking what kind of experiment we all agree on what should happen?
Some experiment where we don't agree.
Where we don't agree on.
Yeah, because I think we can come up with experiments where that will show some indefinite causal structure on some very fundamental level, but yet not really teach much about of course, they will discriminate between different physics, but they will still be consistent with very conservative hypotheses with the physics we know. So maybe, yeah.
Okay,
I have an idea for such an experiment. We can propose Fabio jump into a black hole and ask what will happen to him.
Yes. Not be able to.
Okay, I think Lucien wanted to.
I'm just sort of trying to think about this for words in connection with the development of general relativity. So even before Einstein set about developing it, there was this data, the anomalous precession of Mercury. So that existed prior to that. So there's already existing data that was to be explained. And then I guess he bounced around for a while, sort of in this sort of concept formalism. And then he suddenly realized, you know, maybe I can do some calculations, and got very excited. And I think even before he had the full framework of GR, he was able to calculate and show that he got the right answer for Mercury. He also got excited and did a wrong calculation for the bending of light, but then subsequently corrected that before that was confirmed. But I think it took the full theory to be developed before you could have done a calculation like what would happen when black holes merge and the gravity waves that you see, their very particular signature. So it seems like there's lots of opportunities during the construction of a new physical theory for these things to interact, but some of them don't happen until you have the full theory and you can't, you know, so some experiments you may have to wait until you actually have a definite theory before you can start to distinguish think of an experiment to perform.
Okay, we're almost out of time. We can take a couple of comments.
Well, I want to continue on that, saying, let's imagine that we are, like, you know, before Einstein time. right? So we don't have the... what's interesting is that Einstein predicted the bending of light, but in fact, that with the first time was the factor 1/2, and then was the factor 2. And in fact, you know, last year was measured, with the anniversary in Prince Island. What was interesting is that 100 years before Einstein, a student of Newton, based on the wrong ID, predicted the bending of light too. And okay, he got the factor 1/2, but you know, he predicted the phenomena that was the, so maybe we could think of being that, you know, being at that stage. We don't have the theory, but you know, he predicted an experiment that we should have done that would have been very, very, very surprising without having the full formalism. I don't have a specific proposal, but it would be nice to kind of brainstorm on that.
I think wants to respond.
Okay, I wanted to say what we can expect of. I mean, I'm not experimentalist, but where the people are going now, and you also mentioned this, but I think most of the type of experiments, experiments, will be take a massive as possible object and put it in the superposition. Now, unfortunately, I think that it's. Lots of the people are concentrated on a question of whether there will be, I don't want to, unfortunately, but whether this will be a collapse or not. And then we are already for too long, like, concerned with this question.
Mm-hmm.
And also, experimentalists are usually invited at these conferences to discuss whether there will be a collapse or not. And then whether we achieve this parameter, then we can exclude maybe Girard, we mean Weber, but not Penrose, and so on. But the best that could happen is actually what you are saying, that maybe when we compute in the more hand-wave argument, without having a complete theory, but extending linearity from mechanics, and we compute this, and then we see that there is 1/2 missing, or something like that. But I want actually to encourage people to think of this situation. This is something maybe in 10 years' time, so you can say maybe that. But to be more with larger, like with fantasy, to look at this situation and try to find out. Of course, I think nice thing that should be done is to see whether you can entangle two massive particles via interaction of the gravitational field. This would, in my opinion, say something about non-classical feature of gravitational field, not about gravitons and so on. This would be important. Right? We should go even beyond that, because as Piper said, it seems like everything is what we expect is sometimes we have a feeling that it is a trivial extension, but the hope is that maybe we miss 1/2.
Maybe we have a comment. So.
Yes, I was going to make a comment, which actually is kind of similar to what Chantan was saying. So I was chatting to a philosopher of physics and saying I was interested in new theories of physics beyond quantum theory, working on foundations. And yeah, he essentially told me that it's completely the wrong place to look, that there are areas of physics where there's kind of, no proper, understanding in a sense, and lots of theoretical disagreements, even huge experimental gaps, orders of magnitude. So he suggested more the kind of the semi-classical limit, right? So as you're saying, kind of macroscopic objects, where kind of quantum somehow turns to classical. I suggested just, if you're just taking the principles being suggested, find unexplained things experimentally in physics, which don't have consensus on the theory, and maybe that's where we'll have these effects, which can only be explained by more fundamental theory. So interestingly, it is along these kind of macroscopic superpositions, GKO-style things. Because all our tabletop experiments and foundations are like 6 photons. I don't think, that'll reveal new physics as,
Okay, well, if you're trying to think of experiments, the best thing that we can measure is time, if we say the most precise measurement. Experimentalists, the thing that they're best at is measuring time. So, if you can convert your experiment into measuring a precise time, then that
will tell you. How can you measure it?
What
for the money?
Yeah, how about that? Okay, I think we're out of time now. We have an hour break, and then the banquet is the same place the lunch is on the second floor bistro, beginning at 6:00. Please bring your name tag with a ticket. Thank you all for your participation.